Coming to you live.
We're live.
From the basement of an abandoned training facility where we talk about fighting, training, and events. It's the Fight Mixer Show, where you can hear about all the local and world combat sports happenings. Get ready. It's time to gear up and square up because we're going live.
Live.
And now.
Broadcasting live.
We will broadcast
live
on the Fight Mixer Show.
Are we on? I think we're on.
What's up?
Gabe, what's going on?
What's going on? Not much.
What is going on?
Another day in paradise.
Yeah. Gabe, welcome to Fight Mixer Podcast this Thursday night. And, you know, we're all excited considering tomorrow we get to talk to three kings of Pancras. We get to talk to some of the biggest names of the game. Gabe, what do you think about it?
Well, I mean, so first off, I don't think people understand what Pancras is. Before UFC 1, there was an organization in Japan called Pancras, and they fought with shin pads and open palm strikes. So you couldn't have closed, but you could hit with the palm of your hands. And they had strange rules like you could grab the ropes or, as a way of escaping. It had really strange rules, but it was essentially MMA. And, you know, they changed up their rule set and made it as MMA. Pancras is still an organization. They still hold events in Japan. It is pretty much the beginnings of MMA. And, yeah, it sounds like they're trying to put together another organization and try to build it again. I mean, Pancras at one point was – like it came up in the same realm as pro wrestling in Japan. And there are a lot of very, very famous fighters that fought there. I mean, as you're going to bring up, it's going to be brought up, Os Rutten, Josh Barnett, Frank Shamrock, were all Pancras, you know, King of Pancras. I'm not sure if Frank was King of Pancras, but I know that Boss and Josh were. So yeah, it's interesting in the respect because you and I talk a lot about the history of MMA,
right?
And Pancras is an integral part of that history,
right? And it was like when the UFC started to when the fire was kind of dying down. Of course, the Japan fighting scene before the prelude to Pride was like Pancras because pro wrestling was always popular over there in Japan. And Bas Rutten, who fought both of the Shamrock brothers, Ken Shamrock, who is a notable name, Frank Shamrock, who is Ken Shamrock's younger brother, adopted younger brother. And then you have Guy Mesner, who, you know, his claim to fame was fighting Tito Ortiz in the UFC and his battles, training with the Lion's Den and all that good stuff. And you have Josh Barnett, who I watched him beat Yuki Kondo for the King of Pancras for the Pancras Openweight Championship. So, you know, I always saw, and I don't know if you agree with me, Gabe, but I always saw Pancras as the prelude to like UFC, Pride, the boom of MMA, because, you know, you think about it, Pride 1, the main event was Nobuhiko Takada, who's a Japanese pro wrestler, versus Hickson Gracie, who obviously everyone knows the Gracie family. So wasn't it kind of like the prelude to Pride and UFC, that boom?
Without question. I mean, again, the rule set was different, especially the very, very beginning of Pancras. But, I mean, if you look up Ken Shamrock's record, before he fought in the UFC, he had already had Pancras fights. So the understanding that this is a massive part of MMA history, and they're still an active organization. My good friend Nam Phan, he actually was the King of Pancras maybe 4 years ago now. So it is still an active, you know, organization. Now it's not as big as it once was, and they don't have the money that a lot of the organizations have. But I mean, as far as an active, a long-standing organization, whether it's gone, you know, higher or lower, it's still active. And I think it's very important to look at that as a massive piece of MMA history.
My question is, and especially for you, Gabe, how come Pancras never tried to be competitive with like the UFC and Pride? Because it was you know, always a big deal in Japan. It's a huge, like you said, a huge part of MMA history. Like some of the biggest names fought there. Did they ever pursue you or pursue any of the people you trained with, or did they try to be competitive and get some talent?
I got an offer to fight the number one contender on a 3 weeks notice for $1,000, and they weren't going to bring a corner for me.
Wow.
And I almost did it just to say I could do it, you know, but at this point I had just, you know, my UFC contract was over, and if there's one regret of my career was never fighting in Japan. And, but it just, at that point, $1,000 that like to go to Japan and to not have a corner. I mean, I have friends in Japan. I could have absolutely made it work, but to make $1,000, it just didn't make sense. But they're an organization. I'll tell you that when I was when I was active, Shooto was the organization I wanted to be involved in.
Oh yeah.
And that's another one that people don't, I mean, there are such amazing, Uno versus, Sato, Sakurai versus Frank Trigg. Like there are some amazing, those fights like really, you know, inspired me to fight. Right. And Pancreas was another organization, but like when I was first coming up, Shooto was the one that I really wanted to be involved with, especially because they had the lightweights. And Pancreas always had, because they were so tightly knit with pro wrestling, they always had a little guise of, you know, there's going to be some showmanship and it's not going to be on the up and up. Although, from my understanding, in the recent part of their career, it was just being pure MMA.
Right.
It's a long way of answering your question. I don't know why Pancrase never made that push into the mainstream of, I mean, but like, I think Pride was the 800 pound gorilla. You know what I mean? Like there was Deep and there was Shuto and there was all these other organizations, which had a little bit of Valley Tudo. There's a couple other ones that like in Japan that were pretty big in K1. Pride was just, you know, that was the next level. And there were a lot of Pancrase veterans that fought in Pride.
Right. Right. And when it comes to Pancras, and you have to realize too, the MMA boom happened in Japan before it ever happened in the United States. And Pancras was such a huge part of that. And Shooto, like Sakurai, who fought in the UFC, you know, some of the biggest names fought in Japan before they ever fought in the UFC, like Quentin Rampage Jackson for one of them, Vanderlei Silva. You brought up Anderson Silva, who you mentioned, you know, your former manager was actually, you know, the manager of Anderson Silva, who trained with Shooto Box. You know, they had the biggest names first, Japan, all the names fought there, you know, like, and you know, UFC didn't have as deep pockets as Japan, you know, the superstars were made in Japan. And for Pancras, you know, for Pancras to come back and actually have this documentary on Netflix and to introduce a new audience to Pancras and what was going on in Japan before the MMA boom happened, before, you know, Reebok was all over everyone's clothes and it was on ESPN. I love the fact that you get to introduce a new audience to Pancras and what Pancras is, you know?
Well, I hope that it ignites a more people that have an interest in the history of MMA. And there are so many fights when everyone talks about this fight and that fight. And, you know, I go, dude, there are so many, if you go through the catalog of you know, historical bouts that are out there, and, you know, maybe I'm just an old man that's living in nostalgia. Maybe they don't live up. I mean, I'll tell you, like, I used to think that Bloodsport was the best movie of all time. I watch it now, and I'm just like, what a steaming pile of crap. Maybe if I rewatch those fights, but the nostalgia part for me is that, like, they're amazing. And I think understanding the history of MMA is a massive part of I mean, look, the history is written for a reason, right? And if you don't understand the history of something, how can you understand and appreciate what it is now?
Right.
And MMA is exactly the same. And Pancrase is a massive part of the history.
I'll never forget, and I think my first memories of Pancrase was Boss Rutten fighting Frank Shamrock and Boss Rutten doing those open palm strikes. Because as Gabe alluded to before, it was all open palm strikes. You know, they didn't wear gloves. It was all shin guards. You know, they wore the pro wrestling tights, and you know, it was open palm strike. And Bas Rutten, and you guys can YouTube this after the show. Bas Rutten was striking with those open palm strikes, and you have Frank Shamrock just stick out the fucking tongue,
making faces. Yeah, I mean, dude, I mean, and actually, Bas has some knockouts with open palms. Like that's. You know, I mean, the rule set is a little strange, especially I think the one rule that if you grab the ropes, let's say you're in a submission, if you grab the ropes, then they got to stop. That's just ridiculous. But I mean, those fights, you can watch them and they're exceptional. And the one you're talking about when Frank is making faces at him, unbelievable. And you know, I trained with Frank at Team Quest, and Frank is such a gamer. I train with him when he's getting ready for Phil Baroni. Oh. And he is such a gamer, that guy, man. I think one of my favorite Frank Shamrock stories, and it wasn't in Pancras, but he was fighting in Japan, and he said he was and dude, this is history, that he was so dehydrated that he licked his opponent's back to drink the sweat of his opponent because he didn't – that's how much he wanted to win. That is a level of I don't know, just sheer will that we don't have anymore.
Frank Shamrock was a fucking animal. When he fought Tito Ortiz and I rented that tape, and my mom brought me to West Coast Video, rented that tape, one of the best MMA fights still, and holds up to any fight. I'll put it up against any fight to this day. Frank Shamrock tooled Tito Ortiz and gave him an MMA lesson he would never, ever forget. And you love Tito Ortiz. We all remember from the last show. But Frank Shamrock, and that was like one of the good fights, but he's fought some fucking battles. Dude, I mean,
watch his fight with Ensign Inoue?
Yeah.
Dude, yeah. Wars, absolute wars. And I mean, again, this is the history like that. And going back to, I think we should stand on Pancras, and we immediately veer off and go here and here and here and here. But I you know, Pancras had so many massive, historical matches as well. I mean, you know, I know Josh. Josh has been a training partner of mine in the past. You know, him being a king of Pancras, you know, that I think he holds that belt as coveted as his UFC title, you know? It's important to know that these guys are, you know, when you have someone like a Barnett who's still an active fighter, former UFC heavyweight champion, and he looks at Pancras the way that he does, as coveted, that it does have that weight, you know?
Right. Yeah. And he's a really good catch wrestler. You know, he was a catch submission artist, and you know, he trained with Sakuraba too, right?
You know what? I can't. I mean, he spends a lot of time in Japan. I have no doubts that he did. I trained with him at Eric Paulson's gym at CSW years ago. And I will tell you that he is a brutal, brutal man.
And I remember his fight with Randy Couture and the grit that Josh Barnett showed in that fight. You know, Josh Barnett is always going to be one of those legends in the game, you know, and his fights in Strikeforce, his fights in UFC and Pancras, it all started from Pancras. Pancras. Yeah. Was the birthplace of all these legends and their historic careers, and it all started in Japan. But will it catch a new audience? I mean, will because they, you know, MMA fans are now spoiled. You get the entire experience. You get the flashing lights. You get the biggest names on the planet Earth. You get the most complete mixed martial arts fighting against the most complete mixed martial arts. Yeah, I hope Pancras, people can take a step back and actually be entertained by Pancras fights, because you know it's such a date, I would say dated. Would you say it's dated style, or would you say I don't know?
I mean, listen, there are so many events that people don't pay attention to that are happening all the time, all over the world. Like I have a student of mine that sends me one videos probably every other week, and he's like, check this fight out, and I am blown away with the stuff that one is doing. No one's paying attention to one, at least in the American market. You know, and even Bellator, which has some exceptional bouts, everyone is concerned about the UFC, and rightfully so. They're the new 800-pound gorilla. But I guarantee you Pancras is going to have some exceptional bouts. They're going to have some really fun, exciting fights and fighters that come from that organization. And the Japanese as a whole, I've been to Japan, I think, 5 times now. The first time for 2 months. The fighting spirit of the Japanese is a different animal, you know? And I've been very fortunate. I train with a lot of pancreas fighters. I've had the opportunity to train with a lot of Shuto and even pride veterans. What happened here? Having a technical
issues.
Don't worry, I don't think that. I lost my train of thought. I hope that the American audience can appreciate it. Like when everything is said and done, I really hope that they get the viewership they deserve.
I wish that the Japanese fight scene would build back up and like actually, because we have Ryzen, but Ryzen doesn't really have like a niche market to America. Like the closest Americans had a taste of how great Japanese MMA was when Pride came over and they did the Second Coming and they did they fought twice in Las Vegas, but I think that was just to attract buyers to buy Pride. You know, it wasn't necessarily to build the brand up and to get kind of a foothold on the market of Americans. It was just to show it off. You know, you saw Shane McMahon and Vince McMahon in the crowd for the first Pride event in the United States. You know, that's the first taste that American audiences got that wasn't, you know, it was always like it had a cult following in the United States for like Japanese mixed martial arts. But I loved it. It had the fucking showmanship of pro wrestling. It had the prestige. And that's what it was about, prestige. You had a parade of champions before every event. All the fights were big time, you know. It had those freak show fights with, like, you know, Bob Sapp killing that little Japanese guy. It was just entertainment personified. You know, I wish it really got a corner on the market, you know. I think we lost Gabe. On that note.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, we got
yeah, that. I don't know what happened.
Oh, my goodness.
There we go. Look at that. Yeah, you know what? I was trying to say, and I was just talking to myself. I was at the event when Dan Henderson fought Vanderlei, and I like the one in Vegas. That event blew every UFC out of the water. Like the feeling, because at that point I had already been to multiple events in Japan, and that felt special. Right, like one thing about Pride is they really spend a lot of time in their production, and it feels like a special event. And you know, I look. Don't get me wrong. I've been to plenty of UFC fights. You know, I've fought in a couple of them. But even with that, like the Pride felt special. You know, and I don't want to take anything away from Pancrase. Like again, like this is more of a talk about Pancrase. But I just feel that. The Japanese kind of understand the production side of it.
Right. Did you help, by the way, and we'll talk about Pancrase a little bit more, but did you help Dan Henderson get ready? Because you obviously trained with Team Quest. Did you help Dan Henderson get ready for his
main training partner? I was his main training partner. I basically I worked with him the whole time. I emulated Vanderlei for him. The way Quest was is you trained with everyone in the room. It didn't matter. So I've trained with Dan many, many times, but I mean, you know, I was a lightweight. Dan was a light heavyweight. And I'll tell you, he hit me just as hard as he hit the light heavyweight. So.
And you, did you, cause I'm thinking about the early days. We're talking about Pancrase legends and Dan Henderson actually fought Frank Shamrock too. Were you training with them at that point?
No. I think that they only did a grappling match if I'm not mistaken.
Oh,
yeah, it was this thing called Contenders, which put MMA fighters versus wrestlers. And I could be wrong. I don't think they ever fought, but I know they did this grappling thing where Frank heel hooked it.
And Frank Shamrock actually fought in the UFC. He fought against Kevin Jackson, who's an Olympic, I believe, silver medalist or gold medalist in wrestling.
I'm not enough of – I know that he's a medalist. I want to say silver, but he could be gold. Either way, yeah. I mean, like, you know, high-level wrestler, yeah. I mean, I think Frank armbarred him in, like, 30 seconds.
Yeah, and Kevin Jackson, too. He had maybe, like, one or two wins under his belt, and then this was, like, right off the heels, hot off the heels of the Atlanta 1996 Olympics. And Kevin Jackson's like, okay, how do amateurs make money after this? Okay, we have the Ultimate Fighting. Stepped in there. Ken Shamrock armbars him within like a minute, you know, like Frank Shamrock. Yeah. And Frank Shamrock got his start. Wait, was it his first fight in Pancras, Frank Shamrock?
Yeah. I know enough about history, but not that much about history. And I don't have a fight finder, right. But I believe that Frank started off in Pancras, because I know Ken was originally in Pancras. And then, you know, I think Ken's name, the Shamrock name, kind of built along with it.
Yeah. And Ken Shamrock actually has a win over Boss Ruin, but Boss Ruin actually beat Frank Shamrock. And like you said before, like Boss Ruin, some of his biggest wins were in Pancras, and then he came over to the UFC, and then he fought some freaking wars. He fought against Kevin Randleman, which is one of my favorite fights of all time. Boss Ruin ended up being a commentator for Pride. He fought one more fight against, I think, like his name is, I don't know, it was like some guy in a singlet, and then
WFA. It was I can't think of the guy's name, but the Native Warrior. I was at that fight. They had the fight here. They had the fight here in LA and at the Forum. It was it was a good card. There's a lot of known names. I think Matt Lindland fought and Rampage Jackson as well. So yeah. It was, and that card, it was good. I mean, it was fun.
Quinn Rampage Jackson actually fought against Matt Lindland, who was, he fought in the UFC, and he was also a silver medalist in the Olympics, 2000 Olympics, Sydney.
Yep.
I think a Greco-Roman or freestyle, you know, Greco. And now we're getting all nerdy and stuff, but WFA, and what's so funny about that fight is Boss Ruin's kicking the shit out of him, and Boss Ruin's kicks, did you ever train with Boss Ruin? Because I hear Vietnam flashbacks about his kicks.
You know what? I know plenty of people that have trained with him. I have not had the chance to train with him, but I have heard from many people that he kicks like a freaking mule, and I don't doubt that.
Yeah. Anthony Cruz, thank you very much for watching, and Frank started it. And Chris, thank you for correcting us and actually confirming it for us. But every single legend actually fought in Pancras, and I'm looking forward to talking to every single one of them. And do you know, so I have the entire panel, do you know anybody personally, like
I know Josh Barnett. I know Josh Barnett very well. I know Chris Lytle. We fought in the WC together, and we had a mutual opponent that we both fought that we've talked about. I talked to Chris a couple of times about fighting him and strategy. Who else is on? Frank, I know from training at Team Quest, and from AKA way back in the day. But who else is there? Guy Metzger. I don't know Guy Metzger. I have a lot of mutual friends that know Guy, and they say he's a good guy. I don't know him. Boss is another guy. Like, it's weird that we have a lot of mutual friends, but I've never trained with Boss. I've met him on a couple of occasions, but not enough to. Is that who else is on the panel? Is that it?
Is Malenko's brother, who actually got Ken Shamrock into the UFC, or got him into MMA and Pancras and introduced it to him. Which I want to ask questions about that, to be honest with you.
I have no idea who he is. Yeah, I mean, he's a pro wrestler, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I know Frank, Josh, and Chris. Those are the people I know. And I think of the group, I know Josh the most. I've trained with him a bunch. We've cornered against each other. His fighter versus my fighter. As a matter of fact, there was one time not that long ago, my fighter and his fighter got into a little verbal confrontation, and Josh and I both stormed in at the same time. And it was like the tension was pretty deep. And I mean, look, Josh is so much bigger than me, and I've trained with him a bunch, and he'd beat me up, but I would have stood in front of him. But he's a good guy. So yeah.
Guy Mesner is one of those guys I wish was in the UFC Hall of Fame. Because he was one of the original guys, one of the pioneers. He trained with the Lions then, trained with the guys like Vernon White, like some of the beginning great fighters, like all around fighters, like Guy Mesner and Kevin Burnett, I believe. A couple of
Lions. Jerry Bolander. I mean, there's the Lions then back in the day had some really. And I trained with a couple of Lions then guys in like 2000. Very, very good at leg locks. But just a tough, durable group no matter what.
Right. And also, Guy Mesner had a little rivalry. And this is like, And going back to like the roots, Guy Mesner fought Tito Ortiz, beat Tito Ortiz, and then they came back with a rematch, and then Tito Ortiz beat Guy Mesner. Tito Ortiz flips off Ken Shamrock, you know, hysterics like happen, and then that led to their November 2002 fight, which was the first time that UFC saw that they can actually make money off the sport and make money off the UFC was that pay-per-view. So, you know, it all stems back to like the good old days, you know, like, so we're not too, you know, not too far along from like these big names. Then they go off and they fight in organizations like UFC and Pride and make names for themselves and like kind of like intertwine and, you know, build up to what the sport is today, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you can go to any organization and like, I don't think that Conor guy, started off in some not known organization in Ireland. There are probably people that are watching him, you know, in the small event, and now he's, you know, well known. You know, I mean, I was at Ronda Rousey's first fight at a country club right here in Calabasas. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then she became a massive star. So I mean, you watch any of these organizations, and there's going to be, you're going to see future champions. You're going to see future Hall of Famers. You're going to see superstars, you know?
Yeah. And Ronda Rousey, actually, her first fight was for a promotion called Tough Enough with Jeff Meyer in Las Vegas, right?
Oh, yeah. Those are amateur fights. I was at her first pro fight.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
Apologize.
Yeah. King, it was a King of the Cage event. It was a fun time.
I hope people watch Pancras and watch this documentary on Netflix. We'll be asking questions. Gabe, I'm sure, is going to beat me to every punch because obviously he like experienced the whole MMA, you know, before it blew up. So obviously Gabe's going to have a lot more conversation. Well, are you going to be questioning them? Are you going to be on the panel, or is it going to be me and Justin?
I think it's just you and Justin. As much as I wanted to be there, I have my daughter for only a few more days, and that supersedes Pancras, that supersedes MMA, that supersedes pretty much everything. So,
right on, man. You got to ask me some questions, so I know exactly what to ask these guys. And I'll say it's from you too. So,
perfect.
Hey, how's it going?
I'll definitely get some. Let me pull through the bank, and you can ask some specific questions that might get you punched.
Awesome. Sounds good. And we have our first guest, a little bit dark. What's going on, brother?
Let me get a light on in here.
Please do.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Hey, what's going on, brother?
Man, just hanging out. How are you guys doing?
Doing pretty good. How you doing tonight? How's everything going with you?
It's going good right now. We're just headed up to Tampa, cutting a little bit of weight. First time in Florida, so I'm pretty stoked to see everything, all the changes.
I'm having technical difficulties on my end.
Okay, I got you, man. So, you are training out of Florida. Are you there for training, for pleasure, to fight for Titan? Well, what are you up to? What's going on?
So I'm fighting in this Saturday on the 18th, starting at 5:45. I came from Alaska. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, I work with a guy named Joey David Hackett. Sorry, I'm a little tired and I'm cutting weight. So.
No, please.
My mind's
okay.
All the way there. So I was actually working. I've been here for about a week and a half now. Wanted to adjust because the climate in Alaska is a lot different than the climate here. You went from about like 7% humidity to 100% humidity every day.
Yeah.
So I've been working with Mario Sperry Jiu-Jitsu and KO Zone over here in Miami. So I'm just on my way out to Tampa getting ready to fight.
Got it. And Mario Sperry, he trained with Brazilian Top Team. He's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He fought for Pride, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Holy crap.
Yeah, he's super well-known, around. A lot of medals, a lot of achievements. I've actually was working with him and his pupil, I guess. His name is Javier. And I've been getting like a lot of good one-on-one time with them. So they've helped me adjust to the climates here for sure.
Yeah. I actually saw him when I was a little kid. I saw him fight against Igor Bochanchin. He got a big win over him. Like, Mario, you're in good hands with Mario Sperry. You're absolutely in good hands, especially when you when you train with him, especially on the ground, he's a fucking animal. And like, his stand up is good too. Like, coming from Alaska, like, how's the adjust, like, how's the MMA scene? And that was my first question too. How's the MMA scene in Alaska? Is it as big as it is in Florida and like New York? Like, how is it over there?
I mean, we're trying to make a stand, you know. I fight with the AFC, it's called Alaska Fighting Championship. It's got its own platform. Like, we're on UFC Fight Pass. We just signed a new deal, like extended our 2-year contract had with them. And they are going through new management. So we had the promotion get sold to a guy named Nick Webb. And so I'm pretty sure people know him as Nick Naptime, Nick Heron Webb. And so it's going through an adjustment phase right now with the whole COVID thing. It's kind of slow. But yeah, I wouldn't say it's as big as like California, Vegas, New York. But we're definitely trying to make our stand.
Got it, man.
And the adjustment phase has been, it's different, you know, like it's nice weather. It's like 70, 80 degrees over there right now. Like I said, like 7 to 15% humidity, unless it's raining. But being here, it's like walking through a sauna compared to over there. And so right. I definitely had to adjust to the breathing and just the heat. The heat was a huge part on my body for sure.
Right. And how many pounds did you have to cut?
Oh, man. Around like 55, 60. But I only have like 5-4 pounds to cut. So I'm cruising. I'm cruising.
Gotcha. And Gabe is back with us. Gabe, our MMA pioneer for the UFC, WEC. Back with us. Yes, sir. So
what's up? Sorry about that. I had technical difficulties, so I had to re-log in.
Cool. So do you know about your opponent? Like, what insight do you have on him? Like, what have you been doing to prepare for him?
Well, his name is Justin Slick J. Vasquez. He's a pretty well-known, I guess. He says he's a wrestler and a striker, or he says he's a striker. His best bet's probably going to be to wrestle me a little bit, because if he wants to stand on the field with me, he's going to have a hard night. But yeah, I've just been preparing. I prepare for him the way I prepare for everybody else. You know, I'm not in there to fight him. I'm fighting myself. I'm a real opponent. So I just keep doing what I'm doing, and I work hard every day. You know, I put the time on the mat, sweat it out, and, you know, I watch him, make sure, I like to see his habits, see what he likes to do. And I'm pretty confident that, like, the way I was preparing, that I'll be able to get the W. And I've been training since the COVID started. I never stopped training. The entire COVID, I kept my weight at 160, and I consistently trained 2 to 3 times a day, 6 days a week.
So you're saying your striking is your strong suit, right?
Yeah, I'm very confident in my striking. I'm not scared of the ground either, though. I have very underrated ground game, and people haven't really got to see it a lot, especially like some of the last few bouts that I've had. They weren't really on the ground. I kept them on the feet, and the ones that were on the ground, I was going against people that were a lot more experienced on the ground than I was. So I would make like minor mistakes as to holding on to something for too long, and they would capitalize on that. But I'm not scared of the ground. I would say it's just a couple steps behind.
And you feel like you've fixed those mistakes and that you're ready to – and you said the guy you're fighting is a wrestler. So you're saying that like, let's be honest, he's going to take you down, right? So do you think you've made enough – okay, I hope your defense, but let's say – you feel like you've fixed the mistakes on the ground, that you're going to be as much of a threat there as you are on the feet?
Yes, completely, 100%. And, you know, I was a wrestler myself. I wrestled all through middle school and high school, and I wrestled collegiate wrestlers. So I'm not scared of grapple. Holding on to stuff was too long. So I think it'll be a good match. If he wants to try to take me down, I'm not scared. I might even try them. So
cool. So Yeah, your last fight was March. Not much of a layoff. You jumped right back into it, jumped right into fight camp, getting ready to fight again. What did you take from the last fight, and what learning experiences you learned from the last fight, and what you're going to do to carry on to this fight?
Just being more patient, you know, because I definitely have knockout power. Having more patience with that excitement, watching them fall to the ground, you know, knowing when it's time to strike and to jump on them.
Gotcha. So with this, what's the game plan? Like, where do you see yourself going? Do you want to fight for the title in the promotion? Do you want to, you know, go fight somewhere else? Do you want to travel, you know, make your ways around? I mean, you're coming from Alaska, and you know, you came from another side of the world to come here. So what's your game plan? Staying with this promotion, maybe traveling around, or like kind of having this ass-kicking world tour, or what's going to go on with you?
So I definitely do want to move up. I'm trying to get out of Alaska currently, actually. I'm just trying to get my connections up to make moves out of there. I was working on moving down to Las Vegas last year, but until COVID happened, so it kind of put a halt to all those plans, which was kind of like a blessing in disguise. So I came down here to Florida, and I've been establishing some great connections. And I'm thinking of like moving down here, and with this promotion, I definitely would like to take, you know, I don't want to just be like known for sticking with one promotion and like one and done it, you know. I want to travel. I want to fight all over the world. I want to fight everybody that I can fight, you know. And I definitely hope everybody makes it through their camp, you know, healthy, so that we can see each other in the cage.
Yeah.
Curiosity. Coming from Alaska, which is not known for a hotbed of MMA, there are plenty of fighters that have come from there. But have you noticed, going from your training roots to then branching out to places like Vegas and Florida, that there's a different pecking order?
Not really like talking mess or anything, but most people in Alaska find it as a hobby, versus, you know, it's a lot of people's lives down here. You know, these people have invested years, blood, sweat, and tears into this sport down here. And so there's definitely a pecking order. It's way different. And, you know, yeah. I've been to California as well. California is definitely a good training area down there. I trained with Anthony Hardonk down at Dynamics. I lost you guys.
Tony's a good close friend of mine.
Who? Anthony Hardonk?
Yeah, how long were you at Tony's?
I was training over there for about 3 months. You know, me and my brother went down there at the end of 2018. We got the opportunity by one of our buddies. He bought us plane tickets, and we got to fly down there. We actually lived in the gym for a few weeks, and you know, trained on the mats that we slept on, and it was a beautiful experience. And they treated us nice out there. They treated us very nice.
And did you get some wrestling?
Very good.
You get some wrestling with Vladdy?
Yeah, Vladdy. We trained with Vladdy, Kevin Casey. I forget one guy's name is Amar. Amar was another like jiu-jitsu guy that we rolled with. Thank you. Cool. Yeah. What's we rolled with Vladimir Klitschko. He was very, very talented wrestler. His hands are massive.
He's a big, strong Russian.
Yeah, he's not little. But yeah, no, we had a good experience over there. I really appreciated all the time that they invested in me and my brother over there. But then I ended up going back to Alaska because I have a son that was just born that year in 2017 in December. And so my brother stayed there, and he transferred over to Black House.
Okay, yeah. So so you said you have a son now. Is that difficult to are you going to transfer your whole family to wherever your base is going to be, or it's going to be one of those things that family stays in Alaska, your training camps, you go to visit afterwards, or how are you going to play that?
The goal is definitely to move my whole family over here. And if it means that I have to go first to set the foundation, then that's what will happen. But my girlfriend's very supportive in my dream. She's been a huge inspiration with all the sacrifices she's made for me. So definitely not going to be leaving them behind anytime, you know. So, and yeah, it's definitely going to move the whole family down.
Awesome. And you said you mentioned and you alluded. Oh, by the way, Fatheads MMA, what's up? They ask if you were working on your takedown defense. So what preparations or what type of wrestlers did you bring into the camp to work on your takedown defense? Fatheads MMA, thank you very much.
What kind of what?
Takedown defense. What type of takedown defense have you been working on? Fatheads MMA ask.
Oh.
Or possibly keep it
Yeah, I mean, I work on all type of stand-up. You know, like if you're going to come in on me and try to take me down, you're going to take some damage on the way in. And if you take me down to the ground, you're going to have a hard time keeping me down there. I'm very squiggly. You know, like I said, I do wrestling, so I'm not foreign to the ground. I like to get on the ground. I like to scramble. I like to fight on the ground. And you're definitely going to take some shots when you come in. So if you're ready to get punched in the face, in the ear, on the body, knees, you know, I'll punch you in your legs if I have to.
Did you get a chance with your travels to watch UFC 251? What do you think about those fights? Every fight was fucking crazy, and especially the main event.
I did, man. It was amazing fights. I was a little surprised with the result. I mean, not surprised with the result of Paige. I was just a little surprised at how quick it went down. And exactly, you know, it was just a very quick fight. Upset with the decision of Volkanovski. You know, right now, I consider him, he's kind of like the fake champ right now because he did not win that fight.
Dude, he's got the belt. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. He's got the belt. It's a nice.
There's nothing fake about that belt. Like, you can have your opinion. You can have your opinion, but he walked home with the win check and the belt.
Yep, he walked away with it. That's for sure. So all kudos to him. He got it. But you know, like I said, like. Even Dana White in the post press conference was like, ask the entire press, like, come on, who had Volkanovski up on that card? Nobody. It was 2-3. He had two solid rounds, and he was rallying. In a sixth round, Volkanovski could have taken it because he was rallying back in those last two.
Yep.
But
this is one of my biggest issues is. How people perceive fights and how judges perceive fights are two separate things. And if you leave it to the judges, like, I don't think it's a – I will say this. You can go either way, and just because Dana says something means nothing. But when it's said and done, if you leave it to the judges, it's a matter of perception.
Yeah,
as I'm saying. And so, like – Yeah, and so, I mean, there's nothing you could do. You know, I've definitely had, like, fights in my amateur career, like, robbed, you know, in my opinion. But you can't leave it to the judges, man. You always want to make sure you get that finish. Like, it makes it for certain that you are the winner, you know, that you walked away with that. And yep. I didn't see that for Volkanovski that night. But, you know, it is what it is.
he got it. I mean, it's not.
He got it.
My question, though, is like, do you think, you know, Max Holloway did enough? Because to be the champion, you got to beat the champion. And I saw Holloway and you two fighters, you know, you guys who are, you know, you guys can have your opinion too and let us know. But, you know, I saw Holloway making the same mistakes as he made with the first fight where he was very heavy on his lead leg. He gang kicked. Every shot was started with a kick. You know, I saw Max Holloway making the same mistakes. Even though I had Max Holloway up, I still saw him not making the adjustments needed to win the championship and take it away. I don't know what you guys thought.
No, I totally agree. The first fight, I totally agree that Volkanovski took that one. The second fight, he was making that mistake a little bit, being heavy on the lead leg, and Volkanovski was capitalizing on it. He was punishing his leg. Man, it's just, you know, it's all a matter of perception.
Yeah,
like you said, it's all a matter of perception.
I'll say this: I didn't see the fight. I only saw the play-by-play, and then I watched highlights after the fact. But from what I saw. And again, it's 5-5, so I have no perspective outside of that. Unless Max was taking his lunch every round, there's too much of a – it could go either way, right? And if we go – we say two to Max, two to Volkanovski, then there's one round that could be a flip round. Now, if you're trying to win, it should be every round. You are smashing. There's no there's no way that a judge can be like, that guy could potentially win. So when people say robbery, I feel like if Max was destroying him and dropped him three times – three different rounds, and he still would have lost, then we would have an issue and there'd be a robbery. But if there's enough for the perception for one person to say, I don't know, and that's really what a split decision says, right?
Yeah. He did get a little comfortable in that fight. So I do agree with that. It is what it is. It is what it is, man. I don't like leaving it to the judges.
I'm talking about my ass. I didn't watch the fight, so...
What about Jose Aldo? Jose Aldo, I think he's got to retire. I love him. He's a great fighter. He's brought a lot to the sport. I think this is the final curtain call for Jose Aldo. What do you guys think?
I mean, if he would have won, that would have been a different story. Like, if he would have showed a little, like, different – like, he had some good parts in the fight, for sure. He had some good flurries. But he's getting to that age where it's just time to stop. It's time to stop trying to prove yourself. You know, like, you've already proved everything. You've already been a champion. You've already fought who's who, you know. The stoppage, you know, I couldn't really hear anything, but yeah, I think the stoppage could have been stopped a little earlier. But yeah, Peter Yan just did what he had to do. He went in there and went to work and didn't stop until the ref stopped him.
Yeah,
see, I don't think it's over for Aldo. I think he fought a championship fight, took it to the fifth round, had good showings against Yan. You give him some three rounders against some guys. Now, is he going to be a champion again? Probably not.
No.
Let's be honest. Like, but dude, one of the greatest of all time. Like, you cannot deny Aldo is one of the most gangster dudes of all time. He cleaned out the WC division. He cleaned out the UFC division twice. He's a gangster. But I will tell you, he still has fights in the tank. He fought a championship round against Yan, who has been destroying people. And he had a competitive fight. So I'm not going to say he should be retired, but I will say he will not be a champion.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. My question is, like, who's going to be the next – who's next for him, you know? Who would you see Aldo fight?
I think he should go – after that. You know what? I personally feel that he should go to 55 – And his highlight, and he should just not cut weight anymore, and he should have some banger fights to end it. And, dude, the thing is, he's got nothing else to prove. And whatever fights he has, he said he's going to fight his contract, right? And he's not that old. He's only 34 or 35. Now, admittedly, there's a lot of road mileage on that 35-year-old body. But – dude, Yan is a young dude, and he fought him. He fought him to the fifth round, and he had moments. I thought the second round he won.
Yeah, definitely. I thought he won the second round as well. Like, that's what I'm saying. He had his moments in the fight, like where he was controlling the fight a little bit. And Peter Yan did look a little kind of like he had to come back and change up his game plan.
Well, but Yan is on a run. You know what I mean? So we're in the championship bout. It's not like he was fighting some scrub and he got dusted by a scrub. At that point, you'd be like, it's time for retirement. But you have a championship fight. He should go to 55, so he's not cutting weight anymore. And he should just have some just fun fights. That's my feeling.
So you think the weight cut has like a big part of it on like his performance? What do you think? 45? Dude, what do you think? 45?
I trained with Joe's Day at Black House when he was still at Black House. And he was a huge, huge 45. And he cut so much weight. When he said he's going to go to 35, I'm like, no way. I just feel like it is when your body holds a certain amount, and the older you get, that cut depletes you. It's just too much.
Yeah.
And the reality is when he was seeing him at Black House, he'd be 65, 70. And, you know, that's when he was the 45-pound champion in the WBC. He's a big dude.
Yeah.
Like, and – And
he's,
you know what?
Man, he looks like a freaking action figure.
So my personal feeling, at 34, 35, don't cut that much weight anymore. Like, he's a gangster anyways. Like, you know, there's plenty of fights that you could have at 55 that'd be fun fights. That's my personal feeling.
Yeah.
But all to do what he does is what he does. I'm just sitting here talking. I have no say one way or the other.
Speaking about your career, Jeremiah, and like, do you plan on fighting on other weight classes, or like, kind of as you build that, like as you go and progress throughout your MMA journey, do you plan on fighting on higher weight classes, or do you want to stay at the same weight class, keep things consistent at that weight class, dominate that weight class, or what exactly is your game plan when it comes to weight class?
I want to jump around a little bit, man. Like, you know, I moved, you know, not even moved here, but when I came in here, like, I definitely feel like it's possible for me to get down to 35 with how easy the weight is coming off of me and how good I feel when it comes off. But, yeah, I like the 45. I definitely want to take over a few weight classes. Like, I want to be a champ in a few weight classes. Later on, I'm going to jump to 55. I'm still growing. I'm only 23, you know, so yeah. I still have, like, muscle mass that's, like, you know, all that testosterone. Drones all coming in, like every like growth is happening. There's nothing I can do to stop it. So, yeah, I definitely want to jump up and down, or even and maybe end at 70. Who knows? Or if they create a 65 weight class.
You're 23.
I'm sorry.
I said you're 23. There's plenty of time for that 65 to happen in a career for you.
That's what I'm saying.
So you're good.
I want to. I want them to create a 165 division. I think Dana White needs to get on that fucking bandwagon. They need to create it. You know, there's might be like the middle ground between 155 and like there'll be so many great fights. Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's funny. I was talking with the promoter because like I'm the promoter of Global Legion is giving me a ride out to Tampa right now. And we were just talking about it, like, you know, because they have 25, or they had 25, they got 35, 45, 55, and then they jumped to 70 and 85 and 205. But I think it would be interesting at least to see it a couple times, like to see people not having to lose that weight or as much weight and how much energy and how more explosive the fight would be.
Yeah. I think Dana... you know, Nate Diaz wasn't that the first guy that actually brought this idea? Nate Diaz fucking probably like, you know, super big. He's like, Dana White, listen, man, you gotta create this 165 division, man. I gotta be the champion. Yeah, right. I think like, he inspired this entire movement of making this weight class.
Yeah, shout out to Nick and Nate, man. Those are like the people that definitely inspired me to be an MMA fighter with my brother. So.
Stockton, motherfucker.
Definitely love those guys.
So
Stockton slapping everybody, man.
Stockton, baby, clapping them cheeks. So, who were your biggest influences, especially leading to your MMA career?
Yeah, Nick and Nate Diaz, Anderson Silva, Israel Adesanya. Even though he's still coming up, like I was watching his kickboxing fights. Like when I was younger, I watched him when he was in doing kickboxing and Muay Thai. Senchai, then, you know, I started with boxing, so, you know, I was watching, like, Lomachenko, Canelo, Soto, like, all of them, all the good old ones, but, yeah, definitely have to leave it with Nick and Nate, man. They just kind of, like, wanted me to be that dog. Like, I wanted to be that dog because of them.
I'm curious about what you just said, that you started in boxing. Why didn't you pursue a boxing career?
Because I like to kick people, and I like to grab them. Like, I just feel like, you know, I like to be able to use my whole body as a weapon instead of just my arms. You know, boxing's a sweet science, but, you know, when it comes, like, if you could put everything together, like your hands, your legs, your knees, your elbows, the chokes, the wrestling, like, all that is just, I don't know, man. Like, it feels different to win in a boxing match than it does in the MMA match. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So, like, would you ever consider, like, a crossover bout, like, maybe going to boxing, do a couple boxing fights, maybe a couple kickboxing fights, maybe get to Glory? Yeah, you see, like, a lot of those crossover fights. Would you ever consider it?
Glory went bankrupt.
Yeah, I would love to. Like, I would love to. I'm sorry. Really?
Yeah, Glory went bankrupt last week, actually.
Yeah, I would love to do boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai, anything.
That really bummed me out. Glory just went bankrupt. Are you kidding me?
I apologize.
It went bankrupt last week. Unbelievable. All right, so. Sorry about that. So we're gonna wrap it up. By the way, you know, Jeremiah, if you want to shout out your next fight, where can we watch your fight? Did we lose you?
I couldn't hear that. I'm breaking up a little.
Okay.
Breaking up like the last.
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit too. I think we just lost him, Jeremiah. I think we just lost him. Is he back?
Enjoy, my friend.
Oh, Sam, what's going on, brother?
Hey, how you doing, my friend?
What's going on, brother? How you doing? How you been?
Oh, I'm feeling great. Loving life. Yeah, going really well out by me.
Awesome, brother. Hey, so, you know, we try to get you on the podcast twice. You know, you're a busy man. Completely understand. But, like, what have you been up to, man? Especially with everything going on, COVID going crazy. Like, what's on your agenda?
You know, I've just been working out every day. This week I actually helped my parents move from Wisconsin to Tennessee. I'm in Tennessee right now. We had a good little 10-hour drive down here with a truckload of stuff. And then we've just been spending all week unpacking, enjoying the beautifulness of the state of Tennessee. Sorry, I've got a little girl on my lap, and she's doing everything she can to.
Aww.
Yeah.
And you're a dad too. So you're actually raising kids, making like, you know, raising babies and all that good stuff. How do you balance it out? Like, obviously you're an awesome fighter. You have a great career. You fight for the UFC, but like, how do you balance it out between being this awesome dad and being this awesome fighter?
You know, it's just what I've always done. It's never been one or the other. It's always just kind of been a combination of the two. So when they're not around, I don't train as well. I mean, I'm distracted a lot more. I'm bored a lot more. So I've really just grown up in the fighting game with the fighting family, and I've loved every second.
Excellent. And just mention this, with everything going on, of course, you want to keep your family safe. You want to make sure your family's healthy, happy. And with the UFC career, have they tapped you on the shoulder yet to fight for Fight Island or wherever that's called? Or like, have they?
Oh, I broke my hand about 3 weeks before my last fight. And I just got cleared last week. My hand just got cleared. So I've been running a lot. I've actually been doing everything except with my left hand. So now I'm gonna spend a week using that, and then I'm gonna hit up the UFC and see if I can get on that island.
There you go. Any fights on the horizon, or did they throw any potential opponents? Or,
I don't have anything lined up. They haven't offered me anything just yet. They know me. If they offer me, I'm gonna, you know, whether I'm broken or not, I'm gonna accept it.
Right. So. Doesn't it worry? Like, isn't it like a thing of worry? Because I was watching the documentary on YouTube about what made the Fighter Island and the stringent testing that they had to go through. Like, they did like 8,000 tests for UFC 251. Going to training camp, I'm sure, is a concern of yours as a father, and you know. So like, are you at all concerned with? You know, with the training and the preparation going to the fight and then making the travel to Abu Dhabi, is that a concern of yours or a fear of yours or any concerns?
No, not at all. I've got 20 fights in the UFC, and I think I've only fought 6 or 7 times in the States. So I've always been the guy they call that travels. Abu Dhabi would be great. It'd be hot. I'm a ginger, so I'd have to run shadow to shadow. But I don't think it would bother me at all. They could stick whatever they needed up my nose. They could blood test me. They could do anything they wanted. But it is a dream of mine to fight on that Fight Island.
Awesome. Hey, who are you currently training with? Who's your current training partners?
Well, Dan Henderson is my head coach. He owns the gym. He still comes in there and beats all of us up. But I get Dom Reyes is a good training partner of mine. Jamal Progus, Sean Strickland. He's one probably my best round. Jared Vandera, he's another good one. So I've got a lot of guys my size, a lot of guys bigger than me A lot of guys a little smaller than me. I've really been had a good couple of camps. I just wish it, I wish I'd show up a little bit in the fights.
Yeah. So you're at Dan's gym, and Dan still comes in and trains with everybody?
Oh yeah. I mean, he's not, but he is. He's often enough.
Yeah.
He comes in, he beats us all up, and he leaves. He's good for three rounds, but he's really good for three rounds.
I know all about that. I was at Team Quest for probably 2 years. Okay. This is before you. I know your name, but I've never trained with you, obviously. But I was there a little, probably maybe a year and a half before you came on to the Team Quest. And I was Dan Henderson gym.
Yeah, so you were there with Christoph and Mayhem and a couple of those other guys.
Oh yeah. I was there. I initially started with Sean Tompkins and all of those Yahoos. Yeah.
Yeah, I've met Sean a couple times, but I've never really done much with him. So yeah, you would have been there just. But I've been there. I was doing the math. I've been there about 9.5 years right now. I think I'm coming up on year 10.
Wow. Yeah. I've been retired now for 6 years. So that makes sense. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
As I'm
but I was gonna. I know those training rounds with Dan are always intense, and he goes for the kill no matter who you are.
He does, and then he'll hit you, and he always says, "Oh, I pulled the punch." I don't know
what you're talking about.
Yeah, you kind of went into it. I said, "Shut up!" My ass.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask you this: Has he ever need you in your butthole?
Yeah. Oh, no, I train it. I teach it. He has made it. There's now we get control of the back, and that's all we do. We need a butthole. He said there's no
need a butthole.
Down. You don't need to do anything. You just sit there and knee the asshole until they fall over.
Yep, and it works. It's a very effective technique. Yeah.
100%. It's like my favorite thing to do, kneeing people in the butthole.
Absolutely.
Does Dan Henderson still have that monstrous right hand? Like, are you like? Do people like flinch every time he tries like lift it like an inch to the left? Is he?
Oh yeah. No, that hand, and it's everyone knows it's there, and you can't stop it. You don't see it coming. You don't have any control on when it lands. You just kind of hope he misses. Try and stick the jab as he comes with it. But it's hard to man. It's quick, and it just comes from nowhere.
So how did you like start your MMA journey? Like, how'd you land? Obviously you guys like know the same people, and I know Gabe's story, which is always inspirational, but how'd you land and how'd you get like involved with mixed martial arts to come over to the sport and want to compete?
Yeah. So my story is I never trained anything. I never watched anything, never watched boxing. Wasn't into Taekwondo. Loved Jackie Chan, big fan of Ninja Turtles. Dragon Ball Z, that was a big part of my growing up. And then eventually someone said, "Hey, you want to fight in a cage?" And I said, "Yeah, okay, let's do that." And then I went out there and I almost won. Then I got beat up. They said, "Oh, that was kind of cool." And then they asked, "Hey, you want to fight in our cage again?" I said, "Yeah, let's do it." And then it took off from there. And I fought everyone. And often I turned pro somewhere in there. I didn't start training until... I didn't start really training until after I turned pro. I was probably 6-1 before I knew there was a UFC. It was just something I was doing. I mean, with King of the Cage, they had a... So I fought in Russia. It was my last amateur... Well, almost my last amateur fight. I fought in Russia. I got back Sunday. On a Wednesday, I got a call and said, "Hey, Sam, King of the Cage is having a heavyweight tournament this weekend. You want to do it?" I said, "Yeah, okay." So I went up, I drove 4 hours north in Wisconsin, and it was 3 fights in one night. And I knocked all 3 of the guys out, first round, second round. And so I won $1,000, and you win a contract with us. I said, "Oh, cool." I never got the contract, but anytime King of the Cage was in town, I got to fight for him. I turned pro in there. I still wasn't training when I turned pro. I think I spent the summer like running on football fields and just kind of making it up. After I turned pro, I started my own gym where I was the head coach of jiu-jitsu and striking and wrestling and all that. And since I did, you can't really teach yourself jiu-jitsu very well. We had a strategy: don't get taken down, and then you don't have to worry about it. And that was
so, so,
kind of what we worked every day, not getting taken down. I did that for 3 or 4 years. I just beat up everyone in Wisconsin. It was actually my wife then that that said, "Hey, you know, you beat Wisconsin. You're bigger than this gym. You got to find something else." I said, "Okay, you tell me where to go." And so she did the research. She had it down to, I think it was 3 gyms. It was ATT in Florida, Team Quest, and AKA a little further north. And we kind of just started driving south from Wisconsin. And Team Quest answered their phone first, so we took a right, and I haven't looked back. Made a fantastic choice.
You have no formal training whatsoever. That's impressive in itself. But like, so you just went from going amateur. Who were you training with? Just random people, or were you just fighting with your training?
No, yeah, I never trained. I didn't know it was a thing you could train for. Honest to God, I thought movies fights were real. I'm 0-1 in the street, and that didn't happen until I was like 24. It was just something I thought was fun. I kind of thought, you know, I grew up watching karate stuff, and I was, oh, that's really cool. I didn't realize that every karate movie ever made was fake. I didn't know that you get hit once, you fall, you get knocked out. It was just something I enjoyed doing. I was always a tough kid, grew up hunting and fishing. And, you know, me and all my friends were always trying to out tough one another. You know, I can make that jump. I'll bet you can't. Kind of stuff. And I just stumbled into fighting. I always joke. I mean, it was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears later, but I stumbled into the UFC. It was not something I grew up dreaming of doing. It's not any of that. I was in college before I ever had my first fight. Graduated college. That was my plan, but they were paying me I was making $200 a fight. So I just fought a lot. It paid my rent, and I got to not get a real job. And it was great.
And do you think that, cause I'm always under the opinion, the reason why MMA is the fastest growing sport in the world is because anybody can do it. It's like Ratatouille, you know, anybody can cook, you know, it's built in our DNA. You know, that's why fighting is so appealing to everybody. Would you say that you're pretty much a proof that anybody can fight, anybody can go into a gym and, you know, practice a craft, practice multiple styles and come into the sport? And that's the reason why this was an appealing sport to you to go into training to become a professional fighter.
Yeah, and now it was a different. So I've been fighting for 13 or 14 years now. It was a different sport when I started. I don't know that anybody will ever be able to start like I started, where I didn't know anything about it. I just walked in and I fought. I am sure the guys I fought were easier back there than they would be now. But I had enough of whatever, that little something extra that kept me going to the gym, kept me hitting the bag, kept me doing everything I ended up doing. It is a sport that the most unathletic can. I played trumpet for about 21 years. I mean, I was a semi-professional trumpet player. So that what that means is I never got paid, but other guys in the band did. I was really good at the trumpet. I was a band nerd all growing up. I played some baseball, but I was never any good. Never played football, but it's still my favorite sport. I was kind of a nerdy kid, thought he was tough. And turns out I ended up being kind of tough.
Awesome. Very cool. And Fatheads MMA actually asked, who was your toughest opponent?
My toughest opponent? Nate Marquardt. That was my favorite fight. He hit me so hard at one point, and he never stumbled me in the fight. A lot of stuff going on. Nate Marquardt was one of my coaches on The Ultimate Fighter. So Shane Carwin was the head coach of the team. Nate Marquardt was one of his jiu-jitsu guys. So I got to know him pretty well over those 6 weeks, and what a great guy. I mean, he's better than I could ever wish to be. And I'm trying to be better like him. Then I got the opportunity to fight my coach. I said, this is amazing. I'm so thrilled about this. And, he was just, I remember him on the show. He is, other than Shane Carwin, Nate Marquardt might be the strongest man I've ever done anything with. He was just, I mean, there wasn't a weight that was too big for him, and he just kind of lifted it like it was nothing. And building up for that fight, I was nervous is the wrong word, but I was very aware that he was as good as he was, that he was just the best I'd ever fought at that point. And boy, it was a good fight. It was a fun fight. It was a good time. It was up and down. I think I dropped him in either the end of the first or second, and I kind of picked it up after that. But he hit me at one point, and in the fight, it didn't really slow me down. Didn't wobble me or anything. It was like, oh, that was a good punch. Ow. The next day, I was flying home, and I ended up flying home by myself. I think my coaches and my wife and I, we all had different – my wife drove, but me and my coaches, we all had different flights. And I ended up leaving – at the beginning of every fight week, you get a flock of posters signed by everybody, and you get your gloves and stuff. And I left all my stuff at the airport. I just forgot I had it. And I didn't realize I left it there for like a week and a half. The next week was the Super Bowl, and – I was over at a friend's house watching the Super Bowl, and he has a daughter that I work with in jiu-jitsu class. And so I was goofing around with her. I stood up, and I, like, just about passed out. I just couldn't. Boom. And I sat down. He concussed me so hard it didn't show up until, like, a week and a half later. And it was for like, 2 weeks. It's like I couldn't stand up. And it was just – I'd never experienced something like that. As I took some time off after that fight. It's like, man, he must have hit me. He hit me so hard it didn't hurt in the fight. It hurt 3 weeks later. Speaking of Dragon Ball Z, Hercule, he had a punch like that. Where he hit Android 18, didn't affect her, and so she just faked it, you know, a minute and a half later. Same punch Nick Marquardt hit me with. It didn't hurt me until 2 weeks later. But yeah, so Nate Marquardt was probably my favorite. It was my favorite fight and probably my toughest fight too.
Now, I asked Gabe this question. I definitely want to ask you this question because you started off, what, 12, 14 years ago. Do you feel a lot more pressure now? And I notice how comfortable and cool and calm and collected you are. Like, obviously, you're called Smiling for a reason. You're one of the most comfortable guys in the cage. Like, you see people, they're either tense or they're going in scared or, like, they're really, like, ready to go and they're really – but you're smiling. You're happy to be there. It seems like you have the happiest, like, disposition ever, and, like, you're the happiest guy in that arena. Do you feel a lot more pressure fighting back then where nobody was watching, but, you know, it was a lot less money, a lot less eyeballs on the sport, but you were fighting all in different places for $200 and, like, fighting for pennies? Or do you feel a lot more pressure fighting in front of millions and people – going for your autograph, you lose, you win, everybody knows about it. Like, what was a lot more pressure? More eyeballs, a lot less money? Like, what's the differences between 14 years?
You know, another unique thing about my career and the way I fight is I have never once been nervous. I've never had it. I never meant to be a fighter. I was going to do something else. I was never going to be a fighter. I never knew I could be a fighter. I didn't know any of that. So when I fought, it was literally just because I enjoyed doing it. And I started making a little more money. I think Bellator was the first time I made a little more money. I said, oh man, that was kind of cool. And then I fought the Ultimate Fighter. And then it was the MFC. I started making more money, but I was just enjoying the ride. And now I'm in the UFC. I've had 20 fights in the UFC, I think. And I'm just, every moment I'm in that octagon, every moment I get to talk to Mick Maynard, Dana White, John Shelby, all those guys, Joe Silva back a few years ago, it truly dawns on me how blessed I am, how unique my situation is, and how much enjoyment I can get out of it. So I never really had the pressure when I was growing into it. I know there is pressure on me now, but I still don't really feel it because I know I should be doing something else the way my life was going back then. So it really just every moment I get to spend in that cage in this organization, I just feel blessed for what I get to do.
Is the championship on the goal list? Do you want to fight for that championship, or are you just enjoying the ride? Or
I tell it because, you know, right now I'm slumping. I've been on a 4-fight skid. Given I think I won my last 2 fights. But every fighter who loses said, oh, it was mine. The judges. So I'm slumping right now. And I understand that it would take a good streak to win. And I also understand that on any given day I could beat John. I could knock him out in the first any given day. Getting the opportunity to do it means I have to knock a lot of other people out first. So that championship is on my goal list. I've got to get there, but I'm also realistic in realizing I got a long way to go before I do that. I gotta win some fights. I gotta win whenever my next fight is. I gotta win that, and I got to win it dominantly, and then I got to win another one, then another one, another one. I just got to end
Right. So, you know, you went from somebody that, like, you didn't necessarily think you were going to become an MMA fighter, and then you became a professional, and you fought for the biggest stage in the world. Where you're at right now, what's the missing piece of the puzzle? Like, what do you have to find and, you know, put them together in order to be the athlete you absolutely should be and you absolutely can be?
For longest time, it was my jiu-jitsu game, because for the first 4 years of my career, I was my head jiu-jitsu coach, and I didn't know that jiu-jitsu was a thing. I didn't know anything about it. So I had to get more comfortable on the ground. I've done really well. I think I've got one of the highest takedown defense percentages in the UFC. So I've done really good with that. But I've got to be willing to get taken down. I've got to be willing to do what to throw what I want to throw, even if it means I get taken down. And I've been working with Joe Stevenson the last 2 years, and he has brought my game up to another level. I truly believe that as soon as my brain says, yeah, get taken down, you'll get back up, or get taken down, you'll submit him, I'll be unstoppable. That was the one thing that I think I've been lacking, and I think I've got it now. I don't get submitted in the gym. I know there are people that I rolled with Rafael Lovato Jr., and dude had his way with me. He did whatever he wanted to me. I mean, there was no second. He just did what he wanted to me when he wanted to do it to me. So as long as I'm not fighting him, I feel like I could beat anyone on the ground. And I got to go out there and I got to fight with that mindset. And I've got over 70 fights in me telling me, Sam, don't ever go to the ground. And so I got to kill that voice. I got to kill that voice saying, you go to the ground, you'll be fine.
I was going to ask. So Joe's – well, last time I saw Joe, he's heavier, but Joe's a lighter competitor than yourself. Do you feel like that benefits you learning from Joe?
Yeah, matter of fact, I like don't roll with Joe. I think he fought at 145. I think he's right now about 190, but he's got some medical stuff. He is a teacher of jiu-jitsu, unlike anyone I've ever worked with before. He understands it. He understands my game. He understands where I lack. Great job developing that. A lot of drilling, a lot more drilling now than I've ever done before, as opposed to rolling. Rolling's easy because I'm an athletic dude and I'm bigger than almost everybody. So I can rolling. I roll all day. It's easy. But the drilling is the hard part. We have to do the same stupid move that I'm probably never going to use 1,000 times just so I could use it if it happens. And Joe's been very instrumental in making sure I do that.
I think it's beneficial because Joe's a veteran. You know, there are guys that are just jiu-jitsu players. They're not going to have the same mentality about jiu-jitsu for MMA is a different animal than jiu-jitsu for sport jiu-jitsu.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely it is. And it's nice. My gym, I've got three title challengers in it. So Dan Henderson's fought for it and arguably won it at least the last time.
I thought so.
Yeah, I thought so too. And at the end of the fight, I think Bisping thought so too.
He should.
Yeah. Joe Stevenson fought BJ Penn, lost the title. Now Dom Reyes, who again, I thought he won the fight. I didn't think it was even that close against John Jones. So I've got three guys that helped me with my jiu-jitsu, that helped me with my wrestling, helped me with my game, that have fought. And they lost, but you could argue if they lost.
You know what, though? At that level, winning and losing is there are so many variables that come into play. Getting to that level and getting to the championship, winning and losing doesn't mean anything as much as like getting to that level. You know what I mean? And Dan is Dan. You know what I mean? Like nothing can be taken away from that dude.
Dan is so impressive. I mean, he just beats everyone up. I mean, he does. I don't know, he's what, 75 or whatever he is?
I think he's about 75, yeah.
Yeah, 75 at least. And I'm 34, still in the – and God, he just beats me up some days. If I get two rounds with him, the second round's a lot better than the first. But getting to that second round can be hard.
And you're 34 years old. You're a young man. Like, you have plenty of fights left in you. And I'm 33. We're both young men, but – Well, who would you want to fight next, or who's on your radar?
So, you know, the interviews I've been doing, they've all been asking me, who do you want to fight next? Because I'm the guy, I always call someone out. The problem is I'm on a slump right now. I am 4 fights in the hole, and I'm not proud of those losses. I really don't have the right to call somebody out. But if I were to call somebody out, I would want somebody who's, like, injured, somebody who's not very good at fighting. Somebody, if they could be smaller than me and slower than me, that would be great. Just give me the weakest, most disabled fighter you got and put him in the cage with me.
Hey, I mean, you got to get that win. Let's be honest. Like, it's one of those things that win's important, right?
Oh, it is. No, absolutely. I got to get that win. I need to secure my job with the UFC. I love this organization. It is the best in the world. And I've been blessed to work with them. And I feel bad for whoever they put me up against, because I understand my back's up against the wall and I'm going to friggin' kill someone.
And your striking is a nightmare too. When you're on, you know, your striking gives me Vietnam flashbacks. I mean, you're a very dangerous striker. So with that being said, you know, I guess because your division isn't kind of intimidating, especially with your division having arguably one of the greatest in the world fighting in said division, and that's a lot to live up to. Maybe going up a weight class, maybe going down a weight class, maybe jumping weight classes. Would that be on your bucket list or things to do, or would you consider it?
Well, I know I wouldn't go up a weight class. Nogano is up a weight class, and I'm going to stay. That I'm only one weight class away from Nogano makes me nervous. I got to get further away from him. You know what? I'm actually talking to my coach and talking to the UFC about going back down to 185. I was a big 85er. I'm a middle of the road 205er. And I've always been a fighter. I've always liked fighting with the size advantage. Even though it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, I've always liked weighing in and being the bigger guy.
Yeah. And if you can, I'm sorry, Gabe, were you asking something?
Nope. Just sitting here enjoying the.
So if you could fight anybody from any generation, you train with like Dan Henderson. Well, actually, what's the worst part about preparing for a fight? That's a very good question that one of our viewers actually asked.
The worst part is the weight loss. I when I fight at 85 or I fight at 205, I'm usually walking around at about 220, 220, 225, somewhere in there. At 205, it's easy enough. I lose, you know, 5 pounds, I cut the rest. At 85, I got to lose 20 or 25 pounds and then cut 15. So the weight loss is the hardest part. I do everything real well. I still train like I'm a younger fighter. I still do my 2 to 3 workouts a day, high intensity. I drill when I need to. I push when I need to. I sweat when I need to. But the hardest part is doing all that while dieting.
Got it. And what would be, if you could fight any fight, like, you know, from the past generation to this generation, what would be your dream fight? Anybody?
You know, one of my favorite fighters ever is Anderson Silva. And so I'm going to put his name in there, even though he is stylistically, he's about as bad a matchup for me as there could be. He's just fast. He's long. He's big. Stylistically, it's a terrible matchup for me, but he's the best it's ever been. He brought fighting to that next level. And I would love the opportunity to fight him.
Got it. If there's any rules, I'm sorry, Gabe.
I was going to say, I was in Dan's camp for the Anderson fight, and I'm friendly with Anderson. I actually did a meet and greet and with Anderson, I think maybe 3 weeks before him and Dan fought, and I was so sure Dan was going to beat him. I was so sure. And what Anderson did just blew my mind after going through the whole camp with Dan. I was just like – and – it made me respect Anderson so much, immensely.
And that was before I was watching fighting yet. When Anderson,
thanks for dating me, Dan, Sam. I appreciate that.
Yeah. No, it was. I didn't know about the UFC then. I've seen the fight now. I mean, it's Hendo. I've watched all of his fights. but at the time I hadn't seen it. And now training with Hendo and seeing Hendo got, I believe he got rocked first, took a bad shot and ended up getting choked out. I believe that's what it was. And knowing that there's someone out there that could do Hendo is that was, I mean, that was like prime Hendo.
We had a cage at his house, and we would do all the training, and we had a murderer's row that Dan would go through every day. And I was like, there's just no way. And Anderson, I hate to say it, but he made it look easy.
I'd like to fight Anderson more now. Not current Anderson than past Anderson, but Anderson was just that next level. One of my favorite knockouts ever was when he fought Forrest Griffin. I believe that was the first fight Forrest had after Forrest lost the title, and Anderson went out there and beat him with the backwards. He was walking backwards through a jab. That was just incredible, and he slipped four or five punches, and there's a little boop. And just won the fight. I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw it.
And you know what's so surprising about Anderson Silva? Because I remember the Anderson Silva from Pride where he got tapped out with a triangle choke to Daijiro Takase. So I didn't know that he was going to come. He fought for some promotion in England and then came to the UFC and just obliterated Chris Lieben. Did you guys train with Chris Lieben? Were you guys like a part of that camp?
I know Chris Lieben. But I've never trained with him.
Right.
Chris was Team Quest North. So at the time, there was two separate sets of Team Quest. There was South, and North was Oregon with Winland and Chael and Chris. Chael would come every once in a while and train with us, but I never – and Winland too. But at the time, I don't think – I never trained with Chris. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Got it. So Sam, what's on the future goal list? I know that we talked about championships, and you said that you want to get a win, and you know, obviously we have to get a fight set up, and but what is the ultimate goal? How do you want to end your career? What do you want to achieve during that career before it ends? Like, what's the main objective before
you fight? I think Hendo's last fight was when he was 46 years old, so I'd like to make it 46 in a day. Just to be able to say I did it longer than him. I love fighting. I've got over 70 fights. I couldn't imagine life without this. And I'm fairly healthy. I mean, broke a hand now twice in the last year. But other than that, I don't have any real lingering injuries. And so I just want to fight for a long time. I want to fight. I want to put on fights that people want to see. I want to be that fighter that people recognize, that people want to meet. I want to be that fighter that I always get calls for interviews. That's the kind of career I'd love. I'm a big fan of coaching. I've been doing a lot of that last couple of years too. I run Hendo's amateur team, and I'm one of the pro coaches at Team Quest. And so I'm a big fan of the coaching. But at the end of the day, I'm a fighter at heart, and I want to do this for as long as I possibly can.
And question for the both of you. What do you feel about the gym situation? Obviously, with everything closed down, do you agree with it? Do you disagree with it? What do you feel about MMA gyms opening up or keeping closed? What do you guys think about that?
Let them open. Let everything open. You're gonna get me in trouble talking about the COVID. Stupid virus. I get people to, oh, Sam, you're stupid and terrible, and I hope you. No, open the gyms. We're adults. We can decide if we want to risk it. We can decide if it's worth the risk, and we can decide what we do after that.
Yeah, Gabe, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I have my gym, and I think to an extent that what Sam is saying is correct. We should have the ability to open, and I think as long as we're abiding by proper protocols, and the people that have people that are, you know, that have health issues, they're staying home, and that we're taking care of the people that can't take care of themselves, like the elderly and the people that have immune deficiencies and whatnot. I think that the ability to work out and stay healthy mentally and physically is important.
Got it. So we have a couple questions, fan questions. So, Sam, what toothpaste does he use to keep his pearly whites on fleek? And Jonathan, Johnny.
I'm a Colgate man. Colgate, extra sparkle.
What's the, John Lucy asks, what's the most adversity you faced in a fight? The most adversity that you faced in a fight?
Most adversity. Shoot. Well, you know, my first win in the UFC was against Dylan Andrews. I was down in Australia. And so I flew to Australia. It was an awful loss against Tom Watson. And got down there and I was fighting a hometown guy and all that. And we were squaring up. And all of a sudden, this was quick. It was 15 seconds into the fight. We're squaring up. We kind of jabbed a couple of times. And all, above the crowd, you hear one guy in the audience yell, "Kick him in the dick." And it was, everybody in the audience heard it. And so the audience erupted with laughter. Dylan and I actually erupted in laughter. And, bumped gloves and then kept fighting. And it was great. But that was a pretty scary moment. I feared for my dick there for a moment.
So we're heading towards the end of the show. And obviously, I want to take you away from your family. And do you have any last words, anything you want to say to your fans and us? It was a pleasure having you on, an honor having you on. The floor is yours.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Well, hey, I'm a foster father. I've got 5 kids. One of them's a foster baby who we're working on adoption. I'm going to be a foster father the rest of my life. And I've got a fundraiser right now. As bad as this COVID has been for us adults and all that, it's been worse than the foster system. I mean, it has gutted this foster system. Kids that should have been detected to be in bad situations have not been. They've gone under the radar. And I've got a fundraiser right now that I on smilemma.com. That's my website. There's a little link at top. If you go in there, give me your address. We will get you information on how we're building funds. We're raising money for the foster system, foster children, and particularly children that are aging out of the foster system. So it's smilemma.com. We're having a little challenge, the Make Me Smile Challenge, a little Instagram, social media, Twitter, all that. And it's just little funny things. And if you make me smile big enough, you win $1,000.
Very cool. Sam, Smiling Sam, I want to thank you for coming on the show, talking to us about your career. We wish you the very best of luck. Obviously, we're fans, and we're going to be watching and supporting you every step of the way. And go on smilemma.com. I thank you very much, Sam, for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
You're the man, brother. Have a good one. All right. Gabe, that's our show.
We're done. Vaya con Dios.
Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in to Fight Mixer. We'll be on tomorrow with the Legends of Pancras. I'll be asking all the questions. Hopefully, I'm not nerding out too hard like when I first met Gabe. I hope not. I'm praying, but no promises.
If there are people, they're far superior. So you might geek out for that alone.
You're part of that same group of pioneers. You're part of the same group of pioneers.
Genuine legends. Genuine legends.
Whatever you say, but it on the screen. Thank you very much, Gabe, for coming on the show. Of course, the MMA pioneer, 3-time WC champion, UFC pioneer. Thank you very much, Gabe, for co-hosting the show. And we'll see you tomorrow for the Kings of Pancras and interviewing legends. Have a good one.
Can't wait.
Perfect. Perfect. Perfect.